spanning the globe with an electromagnetic signal aimed at the audio receptors in your brain. This is Sci-Fi for Me.
Greetings, everyone. Welcome to this episode of The Rogues Gallery. Jason Hunt here, and in studio joining me today, Kendall Sen.
Hello.
And Timothy Harvey.
Hello.
Along with the echoes of all of us. And coming in from Fort Worth, Texas, Mr. Jeff Hackworth.
Hello.
And our special guest, who happens to be here purely by happenstance and blind luck, Bob Rozakis. Many of you will remember the name if you are of an age. The Answer Man is probably how I know how Tim and I recognize name. If any of you who were reading DC Comics back in the day, he was the production director for a time at DC. Also, is a writer and I believe an artist as well. And he was
not that.
I don't always get it right. But if you read any of the DC Comics, you had the Ask the Answer Man section in the back. The Daily Planet page was edited by Bob, and he did the Answer Man columns. And I happen to have right in front of me Flash 286, just because I had it out because Rainbow Raider showed up on the Flash a while back, and I had this out for my kid to read. And I'm looking at this now, Bob. I need to ask you, how much work did it take to find the information to answer questions in this column? Because nowadays we've got the DC Encyclopedia, the Marvel Encyclopedia. We've got all these reference books and all this material that we can look back on and say, oh, this is the history of X and Y and Z.
Google
and that. But, you know, for the longest time, especially pre-crisis, there was, I don't think, as much of an effort to keep track of who was what where. So how difficult was it to answer some of these questions?
Without bragging too much, most of it I knew. I mean, I started reading comics back around 1957, 1958. So by the time I got to D.C. in the mid-70s, you know, I had read 15 years worth of pretty much all of the Silver Age stuff. So I knew what the answers were in most cases, and in the cases where I had to do some research, DC had a complete library of everything, so I was able to go in there, and I also had Nelson Bridwell, who was a walking encyclopedia, and every now and then something would come up, and I'd say, Nelson, do you remember where the story was where Bruce Wayne first found the arrowheads in the Batcave? And he'd just kind of go to the file and pull it out and say, here. So, those were few and far between. But the majority of the questions, because there were virtually no reprints at the time, nobody was asking questions about the Golden Age. They were all asking about the characters of the Silver Age and what became the Bronze Age. So since I was reading the books, I knew the answers.
Now, where did the idea for the Daily Planet page first originate? Was that something that you guys came up with,
That was my idea.
Yeah.
At the time, I was the assistant production manager, and I was doing all of the proofreading, so I was reading all of the books ahead of time, and I thought that we really weren't doing as much as we could to promote all of the books on a regular basis, and probably before your time, guys, when I started reading them, they used to have the bottom one-third page at the end of the stories, and one of the things Mort Weisinger would do was the little thing of coming super attractions, and it would, feature two or three of the upcoming Superman books, and including, the titles of the stories or whatever. And that was one of the things that always had me going, oh, I got to get this one or I got to get that one. And, so I went to Saul Harrison, who was the president of the company at the time, and I said, listen, since I'm reading all these anyway, how about if I put together an ad page that, is basically like a newspaper, and like the Daily Planet, and I'll just pick upcoming stories and use the cover art and whatever, and turn it into a weekly ad. And so I did up one or two as a mock-up, and he was like, oh, this looks good. Go ahead. Now, I think that Saul presumed that I had some editor proofreading and going over what I was doing, and the editors all assumed Saul was going through what I was doing. But in reality, I was doing it all by myself. And, you know, so I started doing things. I was doing little word find puzzles and mini crossword puzzles in it, and then they used to give me all of the questions from the readers anyway, so that I would get this stack of mail, and it would be all the questions about the characters. And usually we had this pre-printed postcard, you know, that basically was thanks for writing and had pictures of the characters on it. And so if it was a question that they asked, I would, you know, just scribble an answer on it and send it back to the person who sent it. And then I said, well, why don't I start doing this in the column? Particularly when I'm getting, you know, the same question 9 times.
Right.
So I started running them, and the first few did not have the name of the person who sent in the letter. And so it was, you know, like, okay, you know, send in your letters, and then I started printing the names. And then I started getting buried because, wow, here's a way to get your name in a comic book.
Right.
And so I started getting more and more mail and I mean, stacks of it. And then I started going through and weeding through, you know, finding the most interesting questions, you know, picking the ones that I hadn't answered before. And it just grew from there. I mean, for a while, we were also running separate Answer Man columns. I had my own Answer Man page in a lot of the books that alternated with the Daily Planet. So some books would have the Daily Planet and some would have the Answer Man page because I just had so many questions. And you know, I was basically doing the one-man marketing department for a while.
And how much input did the top editorial people like Jeanette Kahn or any of those people have as far as the direction of that? Did they just let you fly with it and it was all yours, or did you get any feedback or change of direction or anything like that from anybody?
Nope. It was pretty much I was doing what I was doing, and as I said, I think everybody assumed somebody else was watching what I was doing. But, you know, I tried to vary which books I was highlighting in a given week and which characters. The only time it got focused was towards the end when it was only running in World's Finest and Superman Family. And so the Superman Family ones, Julie Schwartz insisted that I focus on the Superman Family books. That was pretty much it.
You know, it's
the only approval I had to get for anything was actually to run the Fred Hembeck strips, because he was the only one that ever got paid for doing anything for the Daily Planet.
Yeah. I was wondering about that. Is he still around? Is he still doing stuff?
Yeah, he's still around, and in fact, he's got a presence on Facebook, and I notice every now and then he's been selling sketches of or redoings of a lot of the stuff he did in the 80s and the 90s.
Really? And it's funny you mentioned Hembeck on Facebook. there is my entry point for my story on how we connected. Because I'm on Facebook, it was on a Sunday, and I'm connected to a number of different Star Trek writers, Robert Greenberger being one of them, and he also has written comic books and whatnot. And this photograph pops up on my news feed on Facebook, and Greenberger's tagged in this photo. And it's from the first creative summit for DC Comics. I thought, oh, yeah, he did write for DC. I'd forgotten about that. And then I saw who had posted it was Bob Rozakis. And I went, wait a minute. That's the Answer Man. So, yeah, it was a bit of blind luck where we were able to get connected here. But I do appreciate you coming on the show. Let's actually talk for a second. Because, Kendall, when we mentioned that Bob was going to be on the show, your point of reference for Bob was Amazing Man,
yeah,
not the Answer Man.
No,
so ask him what you want to ask.
Amazing Man was about 10 years later.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It was, well, because I was, by the time When I started reading comics, it would have been in like the early 80s, or like right around...
Get real close.
Oh, right around 1980. So by that time, your column had kind of been replaced to where the writers of the book would answer the questions, if I recall. So I didn't get that, but I was young enough to where something like Amazing Man was really, because I like to act older than I was and read comics about, you know, older kids, you know, and stuff like that, and superheroes and grown adults. But there was still, I was still young enough to read Amazing Man, you know, because and Ambush Bug and things of that nature that were still, that were geared towards a younger audience, but still, still kind of lived in the DC universe. And I need to know with Convergence, it's Amazing Man coming back.
I have no idea. No one has contacted me and said, "Hey, we want you to do Amazing Man story." So,
no,
the closest we got was Stephen DeStefano proposed and had accepted the Amazing Man cartoon that was on the most recent, I guess it was Batman Brave and the Bold.
Oh, really?
In the episode called Four Star Spectacular, there is a Amazing Man portion of it.
Really?
Which is a variation on the Amazing Man cat-sitting story, which I think is Maze number 8.
Vaguely remember it. Vaguely. It's all a haze.
And it was more the version that Steven had initially come up with. So, yeah, that was one of the few things that they've done with the character, and that was all him. I found out about it after the fact.
That's really cool.
Now, Bob, on those times when a character that you've created shows up in some other medium, is, I know nowadays there's a big fan outcry, especially for credit to be given, you know, properly, and everybody needs to be, you know, acknowledged. There was a big flap about, you know, Steve Ditko and Jack Kirby, and we've got all of these things now where, you know, people need to get credit for their creations. Did you ever have an issue with that, with any of the stuff that you came up with, or did you run into creative people who would come up with a character or come up with a scenario, and then it shows up later, and how was that handled back then?
In terms of, you mean a character I created long ago that's being used more recently, or
right, because like for instance with S.H.I.E.L.D., you know, the beginning of the show, it says, you know, S.H.I.E.L.D. created by Stan Lee and Jack Kirby, and that's one of the first times that we've seen Kirby being acknowledged for a lot of his work. And we know the settlement with Marvel, now Jack Kirby's name is going to start showing up on a lot of things, and fans are more aware now of, you know, the fact that certain people created certain characters. Was there any kind of a discussion? I mean, back then it was all, you know, this is work for, you know, work for hire, and the contracts were not as extensive and detailed enough. Did this ever occur to anyone that your characters could be used in other media at any time?
Oh, I think it occurred to us that they could be, and you know, there were promises that if they were, you know, we would participate, and that happens sometimes, and it doesn't happen other times. You know, one of the characters I created in the Teen Titans was the Bumblebee, and for some reason they seem to have forgotten that I created the Bumblebee, and they made a toy out of her, and they used her in the cartoons, and they sent me one of the toys. That was the closest I got to participation in that one.
Oh, my.
Same thing with Duella Dent, who has turned up from time to time and been used from time to time. On the other hand, I have gotten a royalty because I used Mal Duncan in some Teen Titans stories, and they used him then in the cartoon. So for some reason, they decided I created him. And at least in the incarnation that they used in the cartoons, and had nothing to do with some of the other characters that I created.
Now, was there a Bumblebee in the original Teen Titans back Is that the one you're talking about?
The one from the 70s. From the,
yeah. Yes, back in the 70s.
In the 70s, okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Which is also where Duella comes from, is the first is the Joker's daughter, and then is the Harlequin.
Okay, yeah.
Oh, right, yeah. Right, okay, yeah. Okay, all right.
Yeah.
Well, cool. Yeah. Well, you know, it's wild hearing some of these names, you know, Julie Schwartz and Mort Weisinger and all of these, and thinking, they were Bob's contemporaries. I mean, for us, they're, you know, their names on a page, and we know a little bit of history on them, but it's
yeah,
like...
you guys hung out.
Yeah, it's kind of those things. You know, every now and then, you know, people talking to us about, you know, we get to interview celebrities and we're hanging out with people that, you know, have been on TV or movies, and what we do is so cool. And I'm sitting there going, yeah, but this is Bob Rozakis. He was there with Julie Schwartz. He was there during the day. This is cool. You know, we're having a little bit of.
It's a little bit of hero worship.
A little bit,
thing going on here. I just want you to know that. Yeah,
it's kind of it's kind of like when I was young. I used to ask my early mid teens, I'd ask my mom and just be like, "Wow, what was it like to see Psycho in the movie theater?"
Yeah,
you know, to see Jaws in the movie theater, and you kind of, you know, you're a kid and stuff, and so at some point, you know, my children are going to ask me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what was it like to see such and such in the movie theater?
Star Wars
in the movie theater.
Yeah.
Back to the Future.
Like to,
You
know,
your children may ask you, what was it like to have comic books printed on paper?
Yeah, exactly. my children may ask me, what's a book?
Yeah.
What is this?
I really hope that doesn't happen.
Oh, I don't know.
I used to be a book dealer, so.
Yeah. All right. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to take a real quick break. I'm going to try to figure out this echo. And when we come back, we're going to get into talking about our DC television shows. We'll start with Gotham and go from there when the Rogues Gallery continues right after this. Stand by.
This is Sci-Fi for Me Radio.
We know you like the distinguished competition, so you probably also have an interest in the House of Ideas. We have a podcast for that, Level 117, where we talk Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. and Agent Carter. We also discuss the overall Marvel Cinematic Universe. We gather in the super-secret underground bunker at World Headquarters for recap, analysis, and discussion with a few digressions along the way. No matter what your security clearance, you will be able to listen to our show, Level 117, part of Sci-Fi for Me Radio.
We are vengeance. We are the night. We are Sci-Fi for Me.
Back on the Rogues Gallery, Jason Hunt here, along with our special guest, Bob Rozakis, is calling in from New York. How are you, sir?
And I'm doing fine.
In Fort Worth, Texas, Jeff Hackworth, some of you may know him as the Penguin, if you follow any cosplay at all down there in the Dallas area. And then here in the studio, Tim Harvey, Kendall Sen.
Hello.
And greetings. Let's get into Gotham, because there's a couple of things that I want to talk about just right off the bat. And Bob, you've been following the show as well. I want to start with how utterly worthless Barbara Keene is as a character. Yeah, they are hitting on all thrusters on every other part of the story. The mob story especially, you know, the tension and the maneuvering between Falcone and Fish and Maroni, all of that's written really well. And then you've got Barbara Keene. I wrote in my last recap, I'm really hoping that the writers are going on a long arc for this character that's going to pay off in a way that just twists the universe and ties it up in knots, and everybody goes, oh, ah, ah. Because right now she's not doing anything for me.
She does absolutely nothing to move the story along. No. I mean, she's just there. I mean, every single time I see her, and the whole Montoya love triangle, it just I just sit there watching and I just go, why? You don't need it. And it really feels like there's just some old guy at Fox is like, you know what I like? Lesbians. Let's get a lesbian in this show. This show needs lesbians. And there's a writer's room now, there just going, no, it doesn't.
The thing about it is, though, Renee Montoya has always been a lesbian. So that part of
That's
the character
fair.
Is not. It's the idea of Barbara, and not even necessarily the fact that she's got a history with Montoya, but Barbara is not even a utility character at this point. She, you know, she is there to do some very stupid things to move the plot along. She's a point A to point B character. And
her apartment is there so Kat and Ivy can have a place to crash.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the watchtower.
It's all set dressing. Yeah. I mean, it is just like, hey, there's no way on a cop's salary he could afford this place, so let's come up with a reason why he can live here, well, because it looks really cool.
I like the idea of Barbara being a blank slate, because she has not been fleshed out and given any dimension in the comic books. We don't know very much about her. So, you know, there was a lot of potential with this character to do things with her, and she's hand of the writer every time she shows up. And I don't know, Bob, I don't know if this is anything that you've noticed, since you're an editor for comic book characters, if you're a little bit more aware of that kind of thing or not. Has that struck you any one particular way or the other with her?
I think that part of it is that they're setting something up and they're looking more long term. I think that they've thrown some things in there that you look at and say, hey, wait a minute, I know when this is going to come back. I mean, one of the things that strikes me about the show, and not to go off topic on Barbara, but this whole little bit about they're going to build the waste treatment plant next to Arkham. Well, okay, who's the character that they're setting up who's there someplace,
right,
or will be, who's going to fall into the waste and come out with a white face and green hair?
You're right.
Well, is there such a character?
And there is Bruno, the possibility for a long and since right. they have that luxury.
But here's the problem, is that you run into the same problem when we were looking at Laurie on Walking Dead, when we review The Walking Dead. Is that the audience reaches a point where they just don't care about that character anymore. And you can, I mean, and Aaron Richards, from everything I see, seems to be an extremely talented actress who's just giving not much to work with. And so you end up with this, you have these characters who have potential, but you just watch them spinning wheels over and over and over again and reaching, and the audience begins to become annoyed with the character, dislike the character,
right?
And it's really hard to bring those characters back when you've gotten to that point.
I think to Bob's point, though, that I think they are. I'm hoping, especially in the case of Barbara, I hope they are playing a long game with her, because right now she's useless unless you're wanting to incorporate tropes in the show. But the idea, now Bruno Heller has already said that the Red Hood is eventually going to make an appearance. So the assumption, of course, is that this is the Red Hood that eventually becomes the Joker. But then you go back to a lot of the complaints that people have had about the show so far, introducing all of these villains without Batman. Because the Joker's origin story involves Batman.
Remember though, the Red Hood gang, and at least one of the versions of the Joker origin, was that the Red Hood gang had used that hood previously. So it was like
there's different people wear the hood.
So this could be something that had happened much, much earlier in this continuity than we would have expected from the comics continuity.
Yeah, I think one of the things you have to do too is you've got to recognize that they're disconnecting from the comic books.
Yeah,
you know, they have to tell a story that is going to be interesting to the general population who have seen the Batman movies, who have not read the comic books. I mean, look at the number of people who see the movies versus the number of people reading the comic books.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, they're appealing to the millions and millions of people who have seen it. And so if they throw in something like, you know, young Poison Ivy, you know,
right,
you've got the group of people who've seen the movies. Oh, yeah, I know who that's going to be.
Yeah.
And, you know, don't catch things like the waste treatment plant. And don't catch things like the Red Hood, because it's not in the movies.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that one of the things they're doing with Barbara, as they're doing with Ivy, is they're setting up the character for somewhere down the road. And they want it to be people say, oh, yeah, this has been going on the whole time. As opposed to, hey, wait a minute, where did this character come from?
Yeah.
You know, and I think that in that respect, they are taking, you know, the long view and hoping that, you know, they get 7-10 years like Smallville out of the series. And we'll need to develop additional characters. I mean, they certainly had to go with, okay, let's bring in the Penguin and let's set up the Riddler and we'll set up this character and that character early on, because they wanted to bring in the movie audience.
Yeah.
And the movie audience isn't just going to look at it and say, oh yeah, it's a crime show and it's very dark. I mean, I look at it more like early Dick Tracy more than Batman, because the villains are outrageous, but we're just dealing with a regular cop.
Yeah. Well,
has to deal with them.
I feel like towards the end of their first half of the season, I really feel like those last couple of episodes started to lose their way, and I think they lost their way because they started focusing a little bit too much on Bruce Wayne and Alfred, and that's not what makes this show good.
Well, and some of that actually was a development out of the fact that David Mamouz had done such a good job with what he had been given so far. They said, oh, we actually have some potential here with, mm-hmm. with the Bruce Alfred dynamic. Now they haven't been in the last couple of episodes.
No.
And now we see they're introducing the Gordon Essen affair from Batman Year One, transferring that to Gordon, a pre-married Gordon, I might point out, and Dr. Leslie Tompkins.
Yeah.
And to me, it doesn't have as much emotional impact because Gordon's not married yet. You know, Barbara's left, so you're not actually dealing with any kind of an affair like you do in the comic
book. And
to
Bob's point, this is making it more palatable to the audience. You know, it's like it's a lot easier to root for a guy who his girlfriend left him, and he's having this relationship with this other woman who is very likable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a character that's very likable. Whereas,
well,
Barbara
she was a
is
professional
not,
companion.
Yeah, but it makes it much more. The audience is going to go along with him and root for him in this relationship.
Your movie James Gordon, especially if you look at the Dark Knight movies, is not someone you're going to look at and go, yeah, he cheated on his wife.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just and it is. I don't know, in comics where you can build up that kind of years and years and years.
75 years of history, you can
build
you can
up that
do
kind
stuff
of
like
and go,
that.
Okay, well, you know, here's where Jim Gordon fell down. Here's mm-hmm. where things, here's where he did the wrong thing. It's when you've only got, 42 minutes to tell the story?
Yeah.
And you're always at the threat of cancellation. You always got to keep your numbers up. You can't afford to...
Not in your first season.
That's when you do what Firefly did and just pull out all the stops. Now we're going to get canceled anyway. Let's just do what we want.
which we see happening on Constantine. Yeah. We'll get to that later.
Now, one of the things that bothered me about this last episode of Gotham, and Bob, you've got an understanding of story arc, so tell me if I'm wrong here. I think they got Jim Gordon back in the detective's rank too soon.
Really fast.
Yeah. I mean, it was one episode, one and done. He was at Arkham for one episode, and then he's back blackmailing the commissioner, and that was a fun turn from Peter Scolari, wasn't it?
Yeah.
You're looking at him, wait a minute, that's a bosom buddy, and he's the commissioner. That was fun to see him, but I thought getting back, I really thought that we were going to be at Arkham for another 3, 4, 5 episodes.
I thought it would be part of the arc. Do you think that that was just one of those things, like the writers got in there? It's like, well, we have way less story for this than we thought.
I don't know.
And it's not. And to take him away from Donald Logue is almost criminal.
Yeah.
I think they looked at it and said, well, what else is going to happen in Arkham?
Yeah.
You know, we've got all the crazy guys. They run around loose. They chase them like, you know, like zombies or whatever. And, you know, so are we going to do that 3 more times?
Yeah,
I think that the storyline is much more effective when he's in the police, you know, in the working out of the police station and working with Harvey, than being the guard in the in Arkham. And I really think they just set up that whole thing so that they could set up the electrocutioner episode.
Yeah,
right. You know, the prelude to that.
Well, and it also serves to introduce Dr. Tompkins into the storyline.
Yeah. And how long can you have people going around going, oh, it really must stink for you, Gordon, to be in a uniform.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm just kind of like, ah, this is going to get tired real fast. Yeah. So there was part of me that was very happy.
So what's the other thing? They bust him to be a cop on the beat?
Yeah, exactly. Well, he's giving traffic tickets.
So, okay, he's walking down the street in, you know, the Staten Island of Gotham City, and that's where the villain du jour happens to turn out.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Right. I mean,
that's a TV show from the 80s.
They're doing it
right
as a detective show. They're doing it as villain of the week. And in order to do that, you've got to make it plausible that Gordon is involved somehow.
Yeah,
right.
And, you know, to say, oh well, another guy just broke out of Arkham Asylum while he was there, and so he's going to chase him. And, oh, yeah, by the way, here's another guy with strange powers who just broke out of Arkham Asylum. Yeah.
Well, we have kind of established in the comics continuity that Arkham does kind of have a revolving door.
Yeah.
Well, yes.
I'm
and,
still...
And 9 secret tunnels that the Joker used
yes,
like
right,
every third issue.
Yes, and a helicopter pad. And yeah, I'm still waiting for somebody to tell Ben McKenzie to start growing the mustache. I'm having a hard time watching Jim Gordon without a mustache. it does bother me.
I have kind of bought into the Gotham universe because you know it's like you do have to throw, you know, we're older, you know, so it's like we have all these years and years of continuity that we, you know, like you're talking about him having an affair and stuff, and I just kind of have to throw that out the window. This show does less fan service than some of the other shows. Like Bob was saying, that is like they're going after a much larger audience than...
Well, now the first episode was all fan service.
Oh, that was total fan service.
And I think they dialed it back really quickly off of that because people went,
huh?
Really? You're going to put all that in one episode? It was packed.
I like that they focused on the crime, the mafia, you know, all of those little elements. You know, I like that they've done that, and they have made it a cop show. They've made it a cop versus the mafia show, and that's,
yeah.
And they somehow threw Cobblepot in the middle of that, and I was like, interesting.
Well, you know, if you look at, you know, where he has tended to end up in recent years, he's ended up basically being a crime boss. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's much much less super villain and much more, you know, eccentric crime boss who dresses the way he dresses, but his plan is to make lots of money.
And got the nickname because of the way he walked.
Yeah, which was smart.
To, I think I'll model myself on a penguin.
Right. Yeah.
And all of my minions will be penguins with mind control devices. Now, I do have to...
Sharks with frickin' lasers attached to their heads.
But it does make sense from a chronological point of view that Penguin would be the villain that they put in because he is one of the older villains, you know, in terms of age, if you look at how old all of the characters are in relation to each other.
Yeah, it makes total sense.
Penguin does tend to be the older one out of the group. You've got Penguin, you've got Freeze that are probably older. Dent is roughly the same age as Bruce Wayne. We don't know anything about the Joker. Used to be.
Yeah.
But one of the other things that I noticed, and I have to give props to Lisa Padovani, who's the costume designer for the show, and I have pointed this out before, and Bob, I don't know if you've noticed this, but Barbara is always wearing Batgirl colors. I don't know if anybody else has noticed that, but, you know, and she again, this week, she was wearing purple. And she, you know, she goes, you know, when she goes home to Mommy and Daddy, she's wearing purple. I was like, okay, yeah, I got it.
I didn't notice that.
She's every time. You know, she's purple, black, silver, or gray, and the blue that was on, Yvonne Craig's version. You know, the cowl was blue. Yeah, still wearing Batgirl colors. But other than that, she's useless.
I mean,
wasn't her phone blue too?
Yeah, I think it was. It was one of those things that I just noticed early on and went, and then I can't unsee it, you know? Okay.
Once you notice it, you're looking at it, looking for it all the time.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Right. It's like you buy a Volkswagen, and now suddenly everybody's got a Volkswagen.
Yeah.
They're all over the place. So.
Exactly.
Okay, so we've got how many episodes left this season?
10-ish?
Yeah. What do you think? How are we going to end the season? What are our predictions from everyone? Where are we going to end up? Because now we've got Falcone is on to Fish. Fish and Butch are in trouble, and I think this is the beginning of where we see Penguin start to build his crime empire, maybe.
Do you really think that they would be willing to go to the big showdown between the two crime bosses by the end of this season? I mean, is that...
They might.
I think it's one of those things that initially they had to look at and say, well, okay, if we don't get renewed, what are we going to do?
Yeah.
And now that they know they're being renewed, they can spread things and probably push it back. But then it also becomes a problem of, well, then what are you going to do?
Well, you know what? If they did it by the end of this season, you could end this season with the Penguin going, and now it's my turn.
Yeah. I think
Penguin comes to power at the end of this. I think he has a seat.
I think he comes to it, but I also think that the season finale could be the setup for Falcone and Maroni finally deciding, all right, gloves come off, and we can spend all next year wrapped up in a gang war. Because right now it's just kind of been simmering under the surface, and you know, the manipulation and the machinations, all that. Season two could be gang war.
Well, I think I'd almost rather that than try and wrap it up in 10 episodes. I mean,
yeah.
Oh yeah, I would love that. I think that'd be great, and it would be great television to have all of this take place in Gotham. But again,
the Godfather in Gotham
from the beginning. Mm-hmm. My concern has always been how long before your average television viewer, not the fans, not those people of us that love, you know, these long drawn out stories and stuff, but the fans want to see Batman. It's a show called Gotham. Where's Batman? Where's Joker? And I think Joker is going to appear sooner than we want, because the fans are going to want it, especially after Suicide Squad comes out.
Yeah,
they're gonna be like, when are we gonna see the Joker? When are we gonna see the Joker? That's my concern with all of these. Because the only show that has created a logical reason for these things to happen fast is like The Flash, you know. But in Gotham, this is an origin story of Jim Gordon, not an origin story necessarily of it's an origin story of Gotham,
right?
And you said in one of our podcasts we have to show Gotham falling down before Batman can save it.
Well, and a lot of people have rightly said, this is Law and Order Gotham, and I think the production team has been smart in approaching this as a crime procedural with comic book pastiche on top of it, rather than a superhero show.
Right,
and you know, you bring in all of that, but I think the crime elements is like Bob was saying too. It's better as a crime show,
and hopefully the story and hopefully the ratings stay good enough so it can stay a crime show and not a superhero show, because that's pretty entertaining.
Now, Bob, were you at DC when Gotham Central was published?
The first round, yeah.
All right, how does this compare to that? Because a lot of people, when we first heard about Gotham, a lot of people were wondering if it was going to be an adaptation of Gotham Central or if it was going to have any resemblance to that. Is it close? Not really? Or I mean, I know timeline-wise.
I would say that Gotham Central was basically going to be Gotham, but Batman still existed. He just wasn't there.
Yeah.
Involved in the cases, whereas, you know, I mean, this is a different approach. In terms of, yes, it's Gotham and it's the police department, but there is no Batman to be there. So, I mean, in that respect, yes, they're similar. And you want to see the ordinary police, or ordinary, you know, with quotation marks around it, battling regular crime or, you know, the one step above. And, you know, but I think that's the similarity. I think that what they have to do is continue to make it an interesting story and develop the characters. You know, I think that, you know, a show like The Walking Dead, just to go back to that, has developed far beyond, oh, there's, you know, zombies wandering around trying to bite all of the main characters. It's become a character-driven program. And I think what they're looking for is the same thing here, that you're going to care about Jim Gordon to a lesser extent. You're going to care about Harvey. You want to see how the Penguin becomes the crime boss that he will eventually become. And, you know, to go back to, you know, the millions of people who saw the movies as opposed to the fans of the comic books, you want to be able to, you know, look at something and say, oh, wow, I know who that's going to be. And I don't think that, you know, they necessarily need to show the Joker becoming the Joker that quickly. If they show a character who the audience can consider, hey, this guy's probably going to be the Joker.
Yeah.
And tease the audience. I mean, you could tease the audience for an entire season.
Well, and
somebody
we did.
Who, you know, looks like this is going to become the Joker, and then turn around and bring in somebody else who's been there the whole time.
Yeah.
And say, oh, yeah, well, it's not him. It's this guy over here.
Well, and we did hear the laugh. We did hear the
laugh. Yeah, we heard the laugh
in
Arkham.
In the Arkham escape. Mm-hmm. So everybody went, is that him? Is that him? Yeah. But the Joker hasn't come into his
own
yet.
And we saw the comedian in the first episode. Jim Beavers, for anyone who has young children and knows what the Fresh Beat Band is, Jim Beavers played the part of the comedian.
And Bruno Heller has said that there are a number of people that would be seen throughout the season that could be candidates.
Could be.
That would show up. And now we've got, you know,
I feel like they abandoned that.
It could be.
I tell you what, I would love to see the show run for like 5 years. Let's call it 5 years. And at the final episode.
On Fox?
I know. Yeah. On Fox. Well, okay. Yeah. But say it runs for 5 years, your final episode, you see the Joker. You save it. You just
you get to the point where he comes up out of the waste. And that's the end.
In the waste and just pops up as the end of the episode.
Right, and that's your
series finale.
Going back to Kendall's point here for a second, Bob, let me ask you this. At any point, do you see the show jumping forward in time at all in order to bring us closer to Batman showing up, or you think we're going to stay where we are?
Well, I think we're going to have to jump forward because, if nothing else, the actor who's playing Bruce is going to get older. So, assuming that the show runs 7 years, you know, by the end of the seventh season, how old is the kid who's playing him now?
14? 10 or 12?
He'll be
21. Yeah. So, and that's about the time,
you know,
Bruce left.
You're going to want to move things along and, you know, just jump ahead to fill and, you know, maybe go in and fill in the gaps. But ultimately, you want to get to the point where the end of the series is, okay, Batman's turning up. If there was one more episode, Batman would appear. You know, I mean, similar to what they did with Smallville, where it was, okay, you know, eventually he's going to put on the tights and the cape and fly. And because the show ran so long, they kept having to come up with, oh, we need another story arc that isn't that. And, you know, Clark went from being a high school student to being a reporter at the Daily Planet. With, you know, out ever, you know, putting on the cape.
Yeah.
And I am amazed.
You know, I mean, the one thing I'm hoping is that no one ever discovers the Bat Cave and, you know, discovers there's all sorts of, you know, alien writing on the cave that has to do with some, you know, ancient Indians and mystic religion and everything else so that they can fill a season.
Well, and still, after all these years, I am still amazed at how close Smallville and Metropolis were in that show.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like, wait a minute. No, look at a map. That's,
oh, you mean when you
close.
Climb up on the water tower and you can see Metropolis?
Yeah.
I keep telling you, in that continuity, Metropolis is Kansas City.
Yeah, that's what a friend of mine was.
That has to be.
Always
yeah.
talking about. I was like, it was basically Kansas City.
But now,
which we live here and we know,
yeah,
it's
but
not
now,
Metropolis.
Now Kansas City is Central City now in The Flash. And we'll talk about that. We'll talk about Arrow. We'll talk about a lot of different things in part two of our discussion because we're going to have to break this up a little bit. Want to thank the panel, Jeff Hackworth down in Fort Worth, here in the studio, Tim Harvey and Kendall Sin, and also our special guest, Bob Rozakis, the Answer Man from DC Comics. We will be talking to him a little bit more as well on the next installment of Rogues Gallery. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcasts through iTunes, DoubleTwist, OneCast, Stitcher. You can get the RSS feed over at scififreme.com. You can leave us an email or a comment. RoguesGallery@scififreme.com is the email address. And we will continue this discussion in part two coming soon from Sci-Fi for Me Radio. Thanks very much for listening, folks, and we will see you soon. This has been a presentation of SciFiForMe.com. Copyright 2015 by Flaming Dog Media, LLC. All rights reserved. No portion of this program may be retransmitted without the express written consent of Flaming Dog Media. You're listening to Sci-Fi for Me Radio.